Global Media News on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Ben Lubman.
And I'm Miguel Castro. You're listening to Global Media News from New Media Newsroom on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio. This week in Global Media News, we have media news from China, Iran, Japan, North and South Korea, Saudi Arabia, and Uganda.
From Saudi Arabia,
the killing of Khashoggi. Can journalists be killed with impunity by Saudi Arabia?
From Uganda,
what happens when you attack social media? Why would you do that?
From Japan,
is anime too influential? Is there a link to suicide?
From North Korea,
is there any press or media freedom in North Korea?
From South Korea,
how are foreign esports team being treated by South Korean media?
From China,
me too, and social media in China.
From Iran,
why would a woman be arrested for dancing on Instagram? All this and more coming up on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York.
For the past couple of weeks, the government of Saudi Arabia has been defending itself from the charge that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, ordered the killing of a journalist named Jamal Khashoggi at a Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Can the government of Saudi Arabia order the killing of journalists with impunity? How does Saudi Arabia treat journalists in general? Emily Sorella is here with us to tell us something about how Saudi Arabia treats the media and journalists. Emily, before we get to the brutal killing of Khashoggi, what can you tell us about the freedom of media and the press in Saudi Arabia?
Freedom of media is limited. Saudi Arabia has one of the most censored media environments in the world, Freedom House. This is an advocate group that monitors the freedom in countries around the world. The press, they're privately owned. The editor-in-chief for the newspapers are appointed by the government. Their government has some of the strictest internet practices in the world. Anything that has to do with how their government runs, the royal family, other leaders, religious leaders, will not pass their security check and won't be posted on the media committee to protect journalists. The CPJ was extremely concerned about the loss of our journalist, Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi was a well-known journalist who was living in the self-imposed exile in the United States since 2017. This urges the Saudi authorities to immediately disclose his whereabouts. He went missing and was said to be murdered after his articles post-bled a lot of shocking truths. The CPJ is called on Saudi Arabia to account for what they did with his body or who is going to be held responsible for this death. Khashoggi was one of these journalists who got information and blogged on touchy subjects, and it was obviously a problem for the Saudi government. Realistically, they probably saw nothing else to do but to make sure they would never have this issue again by killing him off. On October 2nd, Saudi officials were also trying to create excuses for death and tried to make it believable that the Saudi government had nothing to do with it. Turkish officials have stated that they are in possession of the video and audio proof that Khashoggi was murdered by a 15-strong team who arrived in the parliament the same day. This situation has caused a lot of unsettled, angry people and officials who are worried about the protection of journalists. There are other cases besides Khashoggi that proved that the Saudi government reacts poorly to journalists' articles on them. In February of this year, a journalist was imprisoned for 5 years, insulting the royal court. A journalist, Khalai, discussed how he regularly reported on corruption and he didn't believe he was doing a bad thing.
So why was the CPJ invented?
Because not only in Saudi Arabia, but other places, journalists were reporting stories that were either getting them in trouble or secretly killed off so the governments didn't have to, quote-unquote, deal with them.
Do you know how many other deaths due to reporting?
7 other journalists have gone missing or turned up dead in Saudi Arabia, but there's no physical evidence, and that's why they keep going missing.
BBC News usually reports on stories. What's their take on the Saudi journalists?
That Saudi Arabia has blamed the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi on a rogue operation for Global Media News. I'm Emily Sorrell. Passing it back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Emily. Brandon Johnson's here with us today to discuss social media in Africa. Brandon, you've been looking at the news from Uganda that the government has imposed a tax on social media. Why did the Ugandan government create this tax, and what effect could it have on social media use in Uganda? Could you start with a very brief introduction to social media use in Uganda?
Yeah, Ben, thanks for the introduction. And, you know, my topic definitely is on the social media tax in Uganda. And basically, to start off with, social media is very limited. Tax that the government is using on Uganda is to basically censorship content being displayed on social media use. We're not only posting news, research, or education, but there's other information that the government doesn't want to allow because they feel like it might harm their country. The president said that he doesn't want the nation to waste time addressing the nation's hard currency, fees paid to foreign telecoms, and also he made a statement on the use of social media saying that luxury by those who are enjoying themselves, or those who are But it's just all the more reasons I'm in favor of that tax. You know, it's unbelievable because this president, 73 years old, he's been in office since 1986. They haven't had a change in so long, and the parliament averages about an age of 64. All these people are very old, and I think they're not adapting to the way of life of social media, right? Because they don't use those sources, so why should we let our people use the sources? And then that's that old school mentality.
So why are citizens so frustrated with the Uganda government?
They're frustrated because, I didn't get to mention this point, but the government is charging 0.5 cent a day, which is 200 Ugandan shillings. And that's very expensive. I mean, we're talking about a country where half part of Uganda, the northern side, is in poverty. Let's be honest, 3.4 million Ugandans are in poverty, only averaging about $1.25 a day.
Wow.
All right. And also from the ages from 15 to 24 are most likely to be unemployed. And that's according to the Ugandan Bureau of Statistics. And this is sad because, you know, this is a country that a lot of people, you know, are sick, they're ill, they can't even afford food, you know, shelter sometimes. And it's sad that you charge people this amount of money. I mean, there has been times where, you know, a journalist who posted, you know, content on social media, her name is Joy Doreen Bira, she's a journalist, and KTV, that's a Kenya TV news reporter, anchor, and she's been convicted of abetted terrorism, right? So for the police who went against the Royal Guards of, excuse me if I'm saying this wrong, the Zulu Kingdom, right? So she posted a video on Instagram showing the explosion. So, of course, they weren't in favor of that. They took it down. They tried to charge it, like I mentioned. And it's just sad because, you know, this is the life in the world we live in. So it's like, if you can't post something, what's the point of even having it? We're not going to put this country in a good light. I mean, look at the parliament, look at the president, as I mentioned, trying to control everybody's content. I mean, that's just sad.
So why does the president of Uganda feel social media is such a luxury?
He just feels it's a luxury because social media should only be used for research and education. He doesn't feel the worth of using it. People want to post, you know, certain things that are not his standard. You should pay. Pay is something that always seems to, you know, be the deciding factor when it comes to, you know, money and the government. I mean, they just now recently changed the age limit for president, so you could be over 75 and still be president. I mean, it's just sad. They don't even give people an opportunity to vote for who they want. And the whole social media hashtag tax must go has been used a lot, but in terms of him not agreeing with social media, it's not going to change that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why protesting won't change the tax situation? And if so, what needs to be done?
We look at America, right? We always use protests. We see the Colin Kaepernick kneeling, you know, standing for social injustices and stuff like that. It seems to not work either still. I guess it doesn't matter what country you're from, but especially in Uganda, I mean, the president, you know, has the authority over the people. And I think he can't relate to the younger generation. I don't think he understands what we go through in society, how just by posting something so minor can get a big effect on their nation. And it's just not going to work because time after time, we've seen people protest. We've seen people lose their lives, you know, just by protesting. Not even in Uganda, we see all over the Saudi Arabia, different nations. I'm just trying to point out. And Uganda, it's just not helping it whatsoever. I mean, no matter how many times you hashtag something or wear a shirt to protest, he's not going to reason with the people. You know, he comes to his parliament and they agree with him too, so it's not going to change anything. And what I think needs to be changed, well, honestly, you keep fighting for your rights. You stand for something. If you don't, you fall for anything. That's what I said.
True that.
So, for Global Media News, I'm Brandon Johnson. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Brandon. Let's head to Japan and talk about anime. Just how powerful is the influence of anime?
Is on the anime beat this week with Brendan Lifford. Let's talk anime. Ben, get us started by telling us why you think Japanese anime had such a big impact on animation around the world.
Thanks, Miguel. So, the anime art style is widely celebrated all around the globe. That doesn't mean the celebration is going to churn out all positive things, though. High Guardian Spice is an American cartoon voiced by Americans with an American art style, and it's flaunting itself around calling itself an anime. The definition of quote-unquote anime seems to have been lost in these past few years. Why is a show that bears a closer resemblance to Adventure Time than any anime calling itself as such, but Avatar The Last Airbender isn't? I believe it's a sign of the times. The lines between what definitively makes anime, anime, are becoming blurred. For crying out loud, High Guardian Spice is being released on Crunchyroll. Anime is becoming more and more mainstream, meaning that more and more people are going to want to imitate it. But the limitation is the sincerest form of flattery. For something to be anime, it has to check off a couple boxes. Firstly, it has to be a cartoon. It also has to be made in Asia. That's it. If your media is one or neither of these things, it's not anime. Stop crying. Don't watch bad shows. A better example of a Western show being influenced by the anime art style is the Avatar series, more specifically, The Legend of Korra. This show has a familiar style, the choppy frame rate we all know and love, and even the gripping, detailed animation. The story's fantastic, the characters are lovable, but it would never call itself an anime. I believe this is because the creators can draw the line between inspiration and imitation. I also would never call Korra an anime. My reasoning? It's made in America. Just as you wouldn't call a burrito sushi, even though they're both rolled food made with rice, avocado, meat, and heavy, you wouldn't call an American cartoon anime.
Absolutely great take on this, Mr. Littman.
Thank you.
Are there any other countries outside the West that are also inspired by anime?
Yeah, it's a couple. One, for example, is France. They have their show Miraculous, Tales of Ladybug and Cat Noir, and it's quite popular nowadays. And as well as Squirtle and Pop Team Epic, which is an actual anime made in actual Japan.
Why did you use Korra as an example, not The Last Airbender?
Because Korra's a better show. I just think, besides it having better animation, Airbender was a story about growing up, but Korra was a flushed-out set of characters in a flushed-out world. Airbender had some really cool places, but they were scattered all over the place and had no real continuity, like an archipelago. I'd much rather live on a mainland than an archipelago, I'd say, as I'm literally living on an island. For Global Media News, I'm Ben Lundin. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Ben. Brendan Lifford is always on the anime beat here, and he has a troubling question. Is there a connection between anime and suicide? Brendan, are there a lot of suicide themes or imagery in Japanese anime? Can you give us some examples?
There's a lot of heroic themes when dealing with anime. So, there's a lot of sacrificing, noble sacrifices. An example can be like in Dragon Ball Z, like when Vegeta sacrifices himself during Majin Buu, my favorite fight ever. He sacrifices himself in a heroic and noble way. So many people might imagine that as something powerful to them, as something inspirational, as something that a hero would do. Sometimes I even imagine myself doing those kind of things, like sacrificing myself, especially when I was a younger kid. Another thing with anime with suicides, it's very image oriented. Like, it's supposed to attack the heartstrings. I remember reading an article in the Russian Times, and the Moscow Times especially, it talked about how the image aesthetic and the visual powers of anime sort of contributed to people committing suicides. And that's, I don't believe that's necessarily true, but they do think that due to the imagery and the Japanese culture and heroic sacrifices and being more that contributes to teen suicides.
For sure, it makes sense. And of course, there's a difference between giving your all for the cause and just straight up committing suicide. Do you think that anime can drive someone to commit suicide?
I don't think anime can drive anyone to suicide, but like, I do hear cases of that where it has drove some people to commit like some sort of crimes. Like, I think it was one article a long time ago where someone was copying Gaara. They put someone's head in the sand to imitate it, and they died. So I think it could commit some people to do some acts, but I don't think it can commit people to commit suicide. I think it's the mental capacity of that individual that drives them to commit that suicide or to commit those heinous acts, especially. Like, I think I heard in one case some African American man dressed up as a character from Samurai Champloo, Negan, and he was shot by the police. So I don't think it's it can commit people to commit suicide because there are so many other crimes connected to different kinds of media and anime, not just one thing.
Well, why is Russia specifically concerned about their youth watching anime?
I think Russia is concerned with it because it's a different medium. It's a different medium from what they usually have. As I was reading in another article by the Moscow Times, it stated how six children, they came from prestige backgrounds, loving families, and they committed themselves to suicide, and they were nervous about it. And so they were thinking, it's anime. Do we then watch an anime, or do we then become influenced by the culture of anime that they committed suicide? Which is completely ridiculous. I mean, believe that watching something to commit you to something, as I said, the mental capacity of that certain individual makes them, they need help in some way to get them off that beaten path of suicide. But they blame it due to the fact that it's coming from another country. Due to it coming from another country, it's their fault.
Do you think that this is just be like one of those ways of governments or places could be trying to just throw anime under the bus because their own mental health systems or mental health abilities aren't really working out enough, aren't doing enough?
Especially, yes. They're using that as a scapegoat. They're using that as a term trying to hide the real issues from their citizens, using something like a cartoon-based medium to escape the real horrors of the country that citizens are in right now. So they're using that as a scapegoat for themselves.
Why does that heroization of anime characters make young teens want to commit suicide? Why, when watching these shows, do you feel the same way?
It's just so heroic. We always think of heroic, well, death, like dying in battlefields, and going to war. Some people go to war just for a heroic death to be remembered for something. And when we watch these shows, like Me and Ben, we watch anime and stuff like that, we see the heroization of these characters that we love and we respect in a way, and when we see them sacrifice themselves in such a powerful way, we sort of want to imitate that. And in a lot of ways, like as I said, when I was a kid, I was always inspired by anime and how they did heroic things, and some bad guys turned good, and they sacrificed themselves for the greater good.
Yeah, some of the characters become like real monsters.
Yeah,
that's really
more than real people sometimes.
I get that. Corey in the house did it for me.
Yes.
Why are some countries like England and Russia blaming anime and anime-oriented media such as video games for teen suicide?
Well, they're blaming it due to the fact that it's our fault and that you're still laughing about Corey in the house, but
yeah.
And that the themes of it. Many animes have different themes, and sometimes they can have a soft, kind theme, and sometimes it could take a different turn. You might think that anime is like very happy-go-lucky, but then it takes a shift and transforms it into like a distorted image of itself. Like the British media is blaming Doki Doki Literature Club for a suit for a young boy who committed suicide. And the game, it's centered around depression, suicide, and death. And the game warns you before this. But some people see it as a happy-go-lucky sort of game, but it's not. It gives you an impression of that in the beginning, but then as it goes in to deeper into the story, it becomes a much more darker, suicidal theme. Where we had a few characters like killing themselves or committing suicide. And so I think they're blaming the British media is blaming that game for that, which doesn't make sense at all, because it even gives you a warning too that these are suicidal and depressing themes that you should be careful of. And I think that the parent of that child should have been responsible and should have been watching and see how the game progressed before leaving the child.
Well, for sure, especially if there's any signs, I think a good parent would probably try to know as best to try to notice certain things before the game in general. If they don't know it until after, and then they blame the game, they won't be paying attention to that to their child. They blame things that they don't understand.
Of course.
I mean, we always have this negative
violence. So,
of course.
So, this is Brendan Lefort. Back to you, again.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's stay in North Asia and talk about media in North and South Korea. Is there a free press under Kim Jong-un?
An
authoritarian state that tightly controls the media, though he initially was looking at a censorship and press freedom in North Korea for us.
So leader Kim Jong-un is the supreme leader since 2011 over North Korea. And he has absolute control over any and all public information that circulates around North Korea. And with one man having so much power over an entire group of people, it's hard for them to progress or have any positive change because everything has to go through this one man who has a specific set of ideas and a specific way he wants to lead. So if things have to go through this one man with one set of ideas, it's hard for any real changes, you know, or progress to be made. And recently, however, even though he has been known to kind of keep North Korea to itself and not allow journalists in and not allow anyone to really know truly what's going on behind the borders, he does allow people in for the parade that they have to try to show the rest of the world, look, we're doing just fine, when in reality, they're completely, you know, impoverished, and the people are, for the majority, not happy, and they're not living in conditions that we would consider as Americans, you know, even safe. He's negotiating and actually speaking and meeting with the leader of South Korea. This is the first time he's doing that. This is big news that he's, you know, even talking and even reaching out. And for us, as from the U.S., this is, you know, good news for us that he's trying to make peace because North Korea was, you know, sending missiles and, you know, damaging their, well, not damaging, sorry. They're, you know, putting us at risk because they were sending missiles over Japan and South Korea. And for us, we were not happy about that because, you know, South Korea is one of our allies. As stated on Freedom House, all domestic media outlets are run by the state. Televisions and radios are permanently fixed to state channels, and all publications are subject to strict supervision and censorship. There is absolutely no sense of freedom within the media, as North Korean citizens, under the harsh dictatorship of Kim Jong-un, they are stuck watching what he wants them to watch. They don't have outlets for self-expression. They don't have outlets to see what's going on in the rest of the world. And it's hard for them to even know what, you know, what is normal, because for them, they were born into a state that isn't normal. So their reality is much different than ours. And but as time goes on, we're starting to infiltrate that a little bit more with, you know, a couple Western journalists getting over there. But still, even when we have journalists allowed into the country, they're shown only the best sides of North Korea. They're only shown what Kim Jong-un wants them to see.
So is something changing in North Korea under Kim Jong-un?
Well, the only thing that's really changing is his ability to now accept contact and meetings with the South Korean leader. So before, whereas he just wanted to keep to himself and he didn't even want to make any contact or have any conversation with the leader of South Korea, now he's, you know, starting negotiations.
Has there been any loosening of the restrictions on the media or the way that foreign journalists are being treated in North Korea?
So as Western journalists are now being allowed to kind of enter, like, they still are only shown what the leaders, and specifically Kim Jong-un, what he wants them to see. So it's almost putting on this facade for the journalists, that way they can only report on positive things. But loosening of restrictions in the media, definitely not. I actually believe, according to Freedom House and all other sites online that talk about the restrictions, it seems as though the more social media grows and spreads across the globe, he tightens the restraints even further. So people, when they're looking, you know, on Instagram, it's like, they, you know, they can't even look on Instagram. They have absolutely no freedom to see what's going on in our world. From Global Media News, this is Logan Mitchell. Back to you, Benjamin.
Thanks, Logan. Let's shift the focus of our discussion from North to South Korea and talk about esports in South Korea. Here's my co-host, Miguel Castro, with an Overwatch League television deal and new teams in esports.
Thank you, Ben. So, recently there's been announced that there will be a deal with Overwatch League where the esports league, known as Over the Game or Overwatch, will be broadcast not only on one set television program, specifically ESPN, But it'll actually be branching out to ABC as well as Disney XD. Interestingly enough, this was announced a couple of weeks back, but this will be the upcoming season, will be the season 2 of the Overwatch League. So it'll be the first time an entire season of any type of esport will be broadcast live on television as well. Usually the only format that, or platform that you'd have to watch these competitions would be through Twitch or YouTube or any other affiliated sites. Now, let's say you're going on a trip and you just don't happen to have internet. You can just flick on ESPN and watch that show. Maybe, you know, you steal your little brother's iPad and watch Disney XD on it. Just get that esports fix. This comes along with the fact that it will now be more globalized due to the fact that with Overwatch League's success in the first season and to the extent of investment, for example, we have the Mets owner that owns the team here in New York, New York Excelsior. There's a couple of Philadelphia team owners as well are invested on the Philadelphia Fusion. These are big owners. This is a lot of investment. This is a big deal. So right now, the new teams that were announced for this upcoming 2019 season are the Atlanta, Green Zoo, China, as well as possibly Paris, Toronto, and Washington. Right now, I know that Toronto just released some more rosters, as well as Atlanta. Interestingly enough, this adds a more international aspect of it because this is one of those few esports leagues that instead of saying, hey, this is a team called Fnatic, or this is a team called Cloud9, it is instead being localized into said population areas. So, for example, the first season's Overwatch League finals took place here in New York, in Brooklyn, at Barclays Center. And interestingly enough, even though New York Excelsior completely dropped the ball, the chance that they had to win the first championship of the league in New York, which, as you can tell by my tone of voice, I'm still very upset about. London's the far one, and so be it. But to the extent of being localized, I know a lot of New York fans. I went out there to watch it. The game ended up selling out in around 2 weeks. So in regards to the new deal, a big thing for a couple of college students specifically, I know that here sometimes the internet isn't that good, or sometimes the servers go down, but guess what's always on? You go to the student minors, there's a television on there, you can watch ESPN. ESPN isn't on, and while they're playing another game, then go on Disney XD. Disney XD's playing some of your old favorite Disney shows, then just go on ABC. The extent of broad reach and just overall compatibility to people that can watch it is amazing, especially considering the fact that after statistics from the Daily Journal, half of all esports viewers don't even play the game. So just to broaden it to that aspect more, esports is just getting more out there.
So we're finally getting esports on TV. How about that?
Hot take. Esports is a real sport. Continue.
I agree. So how successful is the Overwatch League?
The Overwatch League, it started off where half of, like, around a little bit less than 500,000 people would tune in on Twitch alone.
Still a lot.
Oh, yes, for sure. So, to the extent, all the live games were sold out.
Wow.
Specifically, and people were curious to see if the viewers could keep up. And after the season, of course, different games got released, and different esports scenes took off, and of course, the whole new brand new aspect is it lasts a decent amount. Towards the end of the season, not including playoffs, there was about 150,000, 200,000 viewers, which is a great amount considering that other esports found about 60,000, yeah, around 60,000 viewers as a goal. So to keep double that, it shows that not only is it progressing and the fact that these new teams are being included, people from those regions have been watching, because especially the fact that a lot of Canadians were specifically worried, like, who do I support if they're not a Canadian team? And then Toronto came out with a loss, and they're like, I got it. I should.
I remember when Overwatch came out. I never really thought it was going to be, like, so huge. Like, it's getting up there to, like, you know, Worlds for League of Legends. Like, those conventions for those huge games, it's becoming, like, a giant esport. And it is a giant esport now. You can watch it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, for me personally, I bought the game because my friend was like, hey, this is a cool game. You should try it out. I've been really hyped about it. And I was like, you know what? Fine. I'll waste these $40 on a game I'll probably play twice. They hit the game, I'm still playing. That's been crazy enough, and the fact that the esports team's making it this big, where for a time they were the Overwatch League, of course, with the whole new brand new league, it's centralized and really invested in. It was the most watched esport. Of course, League of Legends is really going to top that because it's the main esport, it's the main name in esports, or at least in popularity, because the game is just more than 1% of the population plays it. It's very hard to compete with that.
Yeah.
But close at number two, the next five, it's Overwatch League. So personally, I think that this whole movement towards centralizing this reach towards global, specifically Guangzhou, Atlanta, Paris, these new teams, it's going to be a great thing for putting an international scene, as well as overall just being good for the consumers.
Hmm. So what do you win, out of curiosity, if you take the gold in the Overwatch League?
Gotcha. So there's three splits and one final or playoffs. First split, you win, I believe the reward was $6 million.
Wow, really?
Yeah, so that's split within the team and everything. So that's just a split. That's like a month and a half. Three splits, you qualify for playoffs, and then playoffs, you have the chance to win. I believe it was 20-something million.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. It's a good amount of money. I don't know about you, but hey, these people are playing video games, and they're making money that I wish I could do, especially as a broke college student.
They're making more money in, like, an instant than I see in my entire life.
Oh, for sure. I mean, even if they don't win, they still have, hey, it's okay, we still have around 90K in salary, and everything that we want is paid for, including food, dorming, parties, food, everything, technology. All right, from Global Media News, I'm Miguel Castro. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Miguel. North Korea is China, the most important media power in Asia. The hashtag MeToo movement has come to China.
Welcome back to Global Media News. I'm Miguel Castro. The feminist backlash against male abuse, known as MeToo, has become this global social movement of activists exposing male sexism and abuse in many nations and industries. China is a nation with strong central state that controls the media and attempts to regulate, surveil, and censor the freedom of expression on social media. Can a social media activist movement like MeToo become a major force in China? Will the MeToo movement in China expose male abusers working in Chinese media in the same way the American media moguls have been brought down by investigative journalism and hashtag activism here? Rachel Brommeler is here to talk with us about MeToo and social media in China. Rachel, what attracted you to this story? What is the MeToo movement? Can you give us some background information about the MeToo movement?
The hashtag MeToo movement was founded in 2006 by Tawana Burke in the United States. The movement is to help victims of sexual violence to find pathways to healing. Her slogan is empowerment through empathy. The hashtag went viral in October 2017 due to actress Alyssa Milano using it on Twitter and coming out about her experience with sexual harassment. In the beginning, Burke's goal was to specifically help young women of color from low-wealth communities, but obviously ended up creating this worldwide movement helping women of all races and income.
Makes sense. How did the MeToo movement start in China?
Recently, the MeToo hashtag has been evolving in China. Last January, the movement started in Chinese college campuses, where several women came forward with sexual misconduct allegations against university officials. The Chinese government immediately censored the internet and squashed the movement. A few months ago, the movement started to speak again due to an anonymous woman posting an open letter on WeChat, which is a popular Chinese social media platform, accusing Li Chong, who's a founder and director of a hepatitis B charity, of raping her 3 years ago on a charity trip. At the time, she was only 20 years old. The letter went viral, and before the day was over, Li Chong resigned from his leadership position. The anonymous woman encouraged many other women to reveal their own sexual violence experiences with other leaders and TV personalities. And ever since then, one by one, many nonprofit organization leaders have stepped down.
How is the Chinese government taking control of this movement?
I mean, although it's getting harder and harder to silence these women, the government's still trying to censor them. they blocked the hashtag MeToo on all social media networks for them. The Chinese woman in the woman in China using social media networks have created a new hashtag that consisted of a bunny and a rice emoji. In Chinese, a bunny rabbit is pronounced me and the rice is written as too, so it's just, you know, another symbol of me too. And obviously, it's harder to censor images than it is words. Reporting for Global Media News, this is Rachel Bromiller. Back to you, Dan.
Thanks, Rachel. Let's keep talking about gender and social media. Samantha Campobianco has a report about social media in Iran. It seems that a woman was arrested for posting a video of her dancing on Instagram. Samantha, what happened? How does this help us understand the rules about gender and social media in Iran?
Women in Iran, they have a lot of restrictions against them. According to Shannon Van Sant, she's a national public radio reporter, and she wrote an article, Islamic Sharia law has strict laws for women in public. They are required to wear headscarves and dancing is banned. Instagram, however, has blurred the lines between public and private spheres in the country. The social media site is one of the only Western social media outlets allowed, whereas Facebook and Twitter are both blocked, and pretty much everything else. Madeh Hajabri, she's a teen living in Iran, and she has a really big Instagram following where she posts about her life. And I don't know if anyone's heard of the app Musical.ly, where they, like, have videos and they post, like, dancing and singing along to certain songs. So she was basically making those videos and posting it to her Instagram, where she was, like, listening to Justin Bieber and singing along and dancing. And, well, since it was banned, like, it went viral, and she was actually under arrest, and she was, like, put in prison. She was later released on bail, but, like, she was arrested for just dancing on her Instagram page, where everyone else is allowed to post what they want and, like, share their lives, and she can't even do something as simple as that. So.
Absolutely. Has there been any support for Maiden's arrest?
Yeah, there definitely has. On Twitter and other social media sites as well, they use the hashtag dancing is not a crime. So a Twitter user, Yasmin Altahir, she tweeted, sharing our support for hashtag Madeh Hajabri in London, hashtag dancing is not a crime. And then it was a video of like 50 or 60 women dancing in the street of London supporting, like, they're allowed to do this and they're living their lives free, whatever, and supporting her with that. So that was, and they have like a bunch of more videos of that. So the hashtag dancing is not a crime, there's like tons and tons of videos for support.
So yeah, I really like the fact that they're doing creative ways to protest as well. Has this kind of incident happened before?
Yeah, it has. According to Maya Oppenheim, she's a news writer for Independent News, which is news based in the UK. Something similar happened in 2014 when Pharrell Williams, he came out with his music video for his song Happy, and in the video there was three men and three women dancing on the streets of Tehran, and after the music video aired, those people were actually arrested because they were dancing when they shouldn't have been, and they were released as well. For Global Media News, I'm Samantha Calabianco. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Samantha. That's all for this week. Thanks to Benjamin Lemon for hosting with me this week, our engineer Brandon Johnson, and our producer, Kristen Gray. Today we heard reports from Rachel Dromer, Samantha Capobianco, my co-host, Miguel Castro, Emily Cirella, Brandon Johnson, your boy Brandon Lipford, myself, and Lobo Mission. Global Media News is brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury, Web Radio, and the Media Communications Department here at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. For more media news and resources, check out our latest posts on globalmedianews.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed. Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's OWWRGMN.